This is Prescription Life with Dr. Matthew Harrison on Carolina Catholic Radio Charlotte, 1270 AM. Now here is your host for Prescription Life, Dr. Matthew Harrison.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show, Prescription Life, where we talk about, promote, deliver healthcare information with a Catholic ethical perspective. Very excited today because I have Dr. Stephen Samut on with us today. Thanks for joining us. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, and thank you for having me on. Thank you.
Great. Let me introduce our audience to you. Dr. Samut received a bachelor's in pharmacy from the Monash University in Victoria, Australia, and a PhD in neuroscience from the University of Malta in Malta, Europe. His research interests lie in investigating the interaction between the endocrine, immune, and nervous systems and their role in influencing behavior under normal and abnormal conditions. He has authored and co-authored several papers in leading scientific journals related to the research he has conducted and also presented his work at various national and international conferences. Dr. Samut is currently a full professor of psychology at Franciscan University of Steubenville, Ohio, where he teaches and is also actively involved in research. Dr. Samut's research is focused on investigating the neurological, biological, and behavioral consequences of drug-induced abortion, in addition to the investigation of the abortion pill reversal. He is also conducting research addressing the development of an animal model for embryo transfer in ectopic pregnancy, and in line with his research interests in psychopathology, Dr. Samut also conducts research addressing behaviors that impact mental health. Thank you so much for joining us today. Tell us just kind of your backstory, how you got interested in science and research in general.
Absolutely. I was always interested in the brain. I think my first neuroscience textbook or neuroanatomy textbook was in ninth grade. I was always fascinated by the, if you want to call it, the mystery of the brain. I had wanted to actually be a neurosurgeon. I was always inquisitive. I mean, I had a broad interest in science, geology, numerous aspects. But the brain really fascinated me, and I wanted to do something with it, if you want to call it that. So I started following the goal of getting into medicine in order to become a neurosurgeon. However, that didn't pan out, and I actually ended up continuing in pharmacy. Pharmacy provided me a phenomenal foundation because the way they taught us, the way the course was set up, the way it was set up, it was basically a triple major in chemistry, pharmacology, and pharmaceutics. So you learned how the drugs acted on the body, you learned how the drugs are prepared for human use, and then you learned what they basically do in the body, or how to synthesize them, and that's the chemistry. So the pharmacy provided me with a foundation that I still use to this day. It plays a significant role in my understanding or the way I conduct experiments, because these are all aspects that need to be thought about when one is conducting an experiment that ultimately has consequences on humans. So after I finished my undergraduate degree, it was very difficult at that time to get into research. There was a lack of funding available. But I kept on looking, and I ultimately found a position in my home country, which was Malta. They were starting a neuroscience program, and I was basically the first candidate and had to set up the labs there, which was, again, a phenomenal experience in terms of lab research and just the experience in general. So I continued on with my PhD looking at psychopathology. That has always been my area. The brain obviously is fascinating in itself. It doesn't need a pathology in order to make it interesting, but in the pathologies, and given the prevalence of pathology that exists around us, helps us, is even more fascinating in a way, because you're trying to find out what went wrong in order to hopefully provide some potential solution for at the clinical level. So that's basically been my path. And then after I completed my PhD, I proceeded to postdoc. I was offered a postdoc with Martin Cador in drug abuse research in France, but I turned that down to accept a position at Albany Medical Center in Albany, New York, looking at schizophrenia. And then from there, I proceeded to the Chicago Medical School, Rosalind Franklin, in North Chicago, to continue research on Parkinson's disease, drug abuse, schizophrenia, and the likes, always focusing on psychopathology in a specific area of the brain.
And so how did that, so what years are we talking about here? How long ago was that, that you were like in Albany and
so that was
Chicago?
1995, I started my PhD, 2002, January 2002, I was in Albany, New York. Then 2004, I was in the Chicago Medical School. And then in 2010, I left the Chicago Medical School and came to Franciscan University, where I teach and also conduct research.
I see. And what type of courses do you teach at Steubenville?
I teach the research area because that's my strength. So I teach experimental psychology, which is where we conduct research associated with human behavior, and we do some experiments in some cases pertaining to rats as well. I'll explain those a bit later. But I teach experimental psychology. I also teach statistics, which obviously plays a significant role in the analysis of data that we collect, and also biopsychology, which is basically behavioral neuroscience.
Okay, and then what all areas of that have you been doing research since you've been in Steubenville?
The area of research that I focused on, well, it's two-pronged in a way. So as a neuroscientist, the kinds of experiments that we do tend to be difficult to get results and slow. There's a lot of technicalities that can go, issues that can go wrong. So in order to fill in, I kind of hate saying that, but in order to fill in with publications, because if you drop off the scientific publication radar in this field, it is very dangerous. You're very quickly forgotten, and I don't mean that in a vain way, but you have to stay on top of publications in order for your name to continue to be recognized within the field. So in order to keep up with that aspect, as well as also giving the students some experience in research, but at the same time in an area that is of interest to me, we conduct surveys looking at psychopathology, looking at depression, anxiety, and stress among students and potential causes of those. And that way, I am not leaving my field. I am just, in a way, being truly a behavioral neuroscientist, because what's one of the beauties of my field is the fact that you can go from the cell to human behavior, obviously with caution and prudence. But that's one of the beauties that I love about behavioral neuroscience, because I'm not always in a petri dish. I am not always doing experiments on a rat. If I'm doing experiments on a rat, I'm doing them with the idea of extrapolating with caution to human behavior, and we're investigating human behavior. And then this, the research, the survey aspect, allows me to apply that aspect of research in psychopathology through investigating aspects that are, in a way, affecting students. So I'm always within the area of psychopathology.
So when you're designing a study or a survey, what kind of things do you think about when you're kind of designing that to make it a good, usable, publishable study?
There are numerous aspects, I guess, that I consider, but the first and foremost is its necessity. I don't want to be asking a useless question. People may argue that there's no such thing as a useless question, but I think when you are bringing in money in order to conduct research, I think there is also a responsibility to ensure that what you are doing the funding that you have is also being prudently utilized, but also for the sake of relevance. So I look at relevance, what is going on around me, what has not been answered, and can I, with my background and my expertise, potentially answer such a question? And this is the question that I ask if I'm doing a rat experiment or if I'm doing a human experiment. Doesn't really make any difference. So there's that aspect, the relevance, and then the rigor with which it's done. How is the study being done? There is, unfortunately, a lot of junk that is being published, and I have no intention of contributing to that with my studies. I make every effort that everything that we are doing, and this is, doesn't mean that everything I do is perfect. There are still flaws, I'm sure, in what I do, but I seek to do with the highest level of integrity and rigor in order to make sure that the conclusions that we reach make sense and are reasonable and are of potential use to society as we seek to help humanity in whichever field we are in, be it medicine or research or whatever it is that we are working in. So relevance, integrity, rigor, those are truly fundamental to the way I work.
Great. And then, so you have to do grant proposals. Do you teach how to write grant proposals to students and that type of thing?
In the limited time that I have, because I only see these students for one semester,
mm-hmm.
So in the limited time that I have, and given the complexity of actually setting up an experiment with regards to the surveys, I generally will either focus the students on, let's write a proposal. How do we write an appropriate proposal? And then that proposal will become a study in the upcoming semesters. So I'll go through the IRB. The survey research that I do rarely needs significant funding. The most that there could be is a reward card associated with a drawing that I do in order to encourage people to potentially take the survey. However, the students tend to get, unfortunately, because of the way the system is set up, part of that experience. They will either get the experience of writing the proposal or running the survey and analyzing some preliminary data, because in terms of the analysis of the data, that also generally takes approximately 6 to 8 months after the conclusion of the study, because there is just so much depth that we need to go into. I do not want to publish data just for the sake of publishing data. I want a meaning to come out of it.
Yeah. All right, great. Well, thanks for that introduction. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of your specific areas of research. Thank you, Dr. Smoot, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Carolina Catholic Media News. March happenings at St. Mark's, Huntersville. Mary's Women of Joy Lenten Retreat will be held Friday through Sunday, March 17th to the 19th. Meditations on the Last Words of Christ with award-winning author and speaker Liz Kelly. Go to stmarknc.org/MWOJ for details and registration. The Way for Women Retreat, weekend of March 24th to the 26th in Clarksville, Georgia. This 3 days of guided meditation and prayer for women whose abuse by another has deeply affected their heart, mind, body, and soul. Contact Sue Stubbs at sstubbs@archatl.com. Saturday, March 25th, Order of Hibernians St. Patrick's Dinner Celebration, 6:30 to 10 p.m. at St. Mark's. Dinner, Irish dancing, and silent auction. For tickets, contact AOHMECK2 at AOL.com. For the Carolina Catholic Media News, I'm Pam Cullen. God bless y'all.
This is Tammy Harris. I am the founder and executive director of the Ursus Institute. We fight human trafficking both locally and abroad. I'm also a parishioner at St. Gabriel Catholic Church in Charlotte, as well as the Respect Life coordinator there. I urge you to check out my website, www.ursusinstitute.net, or to reach out to me personally at my email, tammy@ursusinstitute.net. Ursus is Latin for bear and is spelled U-R-S-U-S. And my first name, Tammy, is T-A-M-M-Y. We're involved in many operations right now, such as opening a transitional home for survivors in Western North Carolina. We're involved in a documentary about our work and about the realities of human trafficking, both locally and abroad. We're also giving input into anti-human trafficking legislation, involved in intel operations and rescue operations. There's many other things I'd like to share with you, and there's many ways that you can get involved. So I urge you, please text me at 704-519-7901, email me at tammy@ursusinstitute.net, or check out our website, www.ursusinstitute.net. And again, Ursus is spelled U-R-S-U-S. And please be assured that this human trafficking nonprofit works against trafficking in a way that is aligned with Catholic social teaching. Thanks for your time, and I look forward to hearing from you.
Hello and welcome back to Prescription Life. I'm Dr. Matthew Harrison, and today we have with us Dr. Stephen Samut, who is a professor of psychology at Franciscan University of Steubenville. Thanks for staying with us, Dr. Samut.
Thank you.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about some of your areas of research and where you've published. In 2020, you published a paper in the Frontiers in Psychology on compulsive internet pornography use and mental health. Talk to us a little bit about how that study came about and how it was conducted and the results.
Sure. I think in order to proceed to that aspect, and I think this is also relevant to my other studies that are conducted in animals, one of the aspects that our listeners need to be able to comprehend is the fact that in psychopathology, what we are talking about is an imbalance in the way the brain is functioning, specifically. The brain, if we have to simplify it, can be said to be made up of an upper brain and a lower brain. The lower brain is the more impulsive aspect. You know, it's associated with rewards, survival behaviors. Obviously, there's nothing wrong with that, but that lower brain needs to always be kept in control by the upper brain. If there is an imbalance between those two, then you have a psychopathology. And realistically speaking, all of the psychopathologies that we are aware of, that we know, ultimately end up being an imbalance associated with such with these two regions, the upper brain and the lower brain. So when it comes to depression, anxiety, stress, and various other pathological behaviors, we're talking about this same imbalance. So now bringing it back to the pornography aspect, so in as I said, my area of interest is psychopathology, and one of the things that I have been observing is this continued increase, steady increase. This is across the board in negative mental health. In fact, this was in 2000, a study that was published in 2000, but looking at depression and anxiety, at anxiety specifically, in the between 1950s to 1980s, said that the average American child in the 1980s reported more anxiety than a child psychiatric patient in the 1950s. And this is a normal average child they're talking about. So we're seeing this across the board. In the environment that I work in with university students are a specific vulnerable group. They're in a period of significant transition in their life, And this makes them more likely or more susceptible to potential psychopathology. So we had looked at, in 2013, at potential correlates. And, you know, financial concerns, academics, and other relationship status, those kinds of things come up. But I feel that to some extent, those aspects reflect a more superficial perspective of what could be related to depression, anxiety, and stress. So then we start delving a bit deeper into the reality of the human experience in this day and age. And pornography, unfortunately, plays a significant role in terms of mental health impact. For example, even during COVID, there were reports of Pornhub actually reported, I believe in the United States, it was a 40 to 50% increase in pornography use. So it plays a significant, unfortunately, it plays a significant role in our society. Now, pornography itself causes a dysfunctional perception of the person. It's a person seeking pleasure through an unrealistic perspective that is presented in through pornography. And that in itself is potentially going to cause not just moral issues, but it is also going to cause issues in regards to the person's mental health, because the person is in a way living in an unrealistic world through what they are continuously accessing and viewing. Now, in terms of the upper brain, lower brain aspect, reward, pleasure, whether you're eating a nice meal, whether you're enjoying nature around you, or whether sexual intercourse, eating a nice dessert, all of these aspects always activate the lower brain. In fact, anything of significance will immediately activate the lower brain. And then the upper brain is involved in the processing of that information and regulating it. So what happens in the case of pornography, or what happens when a person is, for example, even abusing with drugs, this reward center keeps on being activated. And the aspect that is kind of scary is that the lower brain has the capacity to continue to grow pretty much throughout the rest of our life. So the more we feed it reward, the more we give it satisfaction without control, the more it grows and the more powerful it becomes. And on the contrary, the upper brain tends to slow down significantly in its growth by the mid-20s or so. And what happens then, and what you observe in cases of addictions, is a significant, you'll see it in the MRIs, you'll see a shrinkage of the upper brain, but you'll also see increased volume in some cases in regards to the lower brain. And what this implies is that there is a seeking of a reward without upper control. Obviously, reward is not bad in itself, but it can go to a wrong level. Now, pornography tends to do similar things. There is significant denial, unfortunately, in the scientific literature and even neuroscience textbooks that say that that pornography cannot be addressed as an addiction. However, and our results showed this, however, the reality is that pornography provides a reward. At the neurological level, even if we're leaving faith out of it for a moment, even at a simple neurological, physiological perspective, you cannot deny the fact that pornography is going to activate the lower brain. And then what that person does and how they act and the lack of control that results in regards to its use is ultimately going to lead to addiction-like behaviors. Unfortunately, many of the psychological associations will also seek to diminish the reality of pornography addiction. However, our results showed what we classified as preoccupation and dependence. And these are characteristics, behavior characteristics, that one observes in any addiction. And then we also found that people were utilizing pornography potentially for emotional coping. So what our results in a way expose is the reality of there is something deep going on behind the deteriorating mental health that we are observing globally. And it is much more than the superficial, oh, I need to talk or we need to talk. Talking is good. Counseling is good. I am not going to deny that necessity. However, we need to take a deeper root, look into the roots of what is going on in humanity. And pornography is degrading to the person using it, to the people who are involved in the pornography itself, in generating the pornography itself. And ultimately, that surely causes a breakdown in the fiber of what it means to be a human being of dignity. And surely that cannot be without its consequences. And that's why then we obviously see the mental health deterioration. Because ultimately, yes, I say this as a scientist, you cannot separate faith and science. They do not contradict each other. They go hand in hand. One gives you the perspective. Science from a bottom-up perspective is the way I look at it, and faith gives you the perspective from a top-down. But the two meet and walk hand in hand. And in fact, our pornography study actually indicated that faith, morals, and personal motivation were the three most important elements that people reported to help them decrease their pornography use. And again, if you think about those faith, morals, and personal motivation, they say something or they do something to the very fiber of a human being of integrity, a human being that deserves respect.
Yes, and you touched on this earlier, but the impact of COVID-19 pandemic on college students and, you'd published in 2022 in Frontiers of Psychiatry just recently, that study about the impact of COVID-19. Talk a little bit more about that. You had mentioned some about the increased use of pornography during the pandemic. What other measurements did y'all use in looking at the effects of the pandemic?
One of the aspects that we were looking at, we were seeking to look at, was coping mechanisms. Because the reality is the hypothesis was, in a way, that if a person has good coping mechanisms, the stress that was being caused in the whole situation would mitigate, would be mitigated by appropriate coping mechanisms. But what disturbed us, and keeping in mind, because the reality was that what took place, we saw a disproportionate response. We had a situation, and we saw the psychological harms of this. We had a death mortality rate of less than 1%, yet we had people committing suicide increases, drug use increases, people losing their jobs, all of these aspects that affect mental health that were not taken into consideration, with percentages in the 30s, 40s, and 50% increases. So what was disturbing in our study, actually, is that even though our students reported primarily using good coping mechanisms, those good coping mechanisms seem to not have any impact on assisting them with regards to decreasing their mental health. So what it said to us is that there's something deeper going on here, because if a good coping mechanism becomes weak in terms of being able to mitigate or undo the harms caused by a stress, then there is something deeper at the very core of the human being that is being affected, that is basically permanently or long-term handicapping that person from being able to respond appropriately, and obviously with negative consequences on mental health.
Yeah, that's a really important areas to look more into, because many of us are still suffering under restrictions of the pandemic, and all of us have our own personal stories of how it's affected our lives. So, all right, we'll take another break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about animal studies and abortion pill reversal.
Hi, everyone. It's Jason Murphy for the Catholic Men's Conference of the Carolinas and the Obligation Radio Show here on the Carolina Catholic Media Network. Registration is now open for the 13th annual Catholic Men's Conference of the Carolinas to be held on March 18th, 2023 at St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church. It's going to be an amazing day of faith, fellowship, and prayer. Of course, we'll be joined, as always, by our own Bishop Peter Jugas of the Diocese of Charlotte. We also have a great lineup of speakers, including Charles Frawney. Charles is the author of Slaying Dragons, What Exorcists See and What We Should Know. He's going to be there to discuss spiritual warfare. Also joining us, Jonathan Fanning. He is an author, speaker, an entrepreneur, and a father. Coming to us from High Point, North Carolina, the Diocese of Charlotte, is Deacon John Clark. Deacon is a former NYPD SWAT officer and former MMA fighter. You won't want to miss this one. Scott Wieman is going to be another one of our speakers. He is with Catholic in Recovery. He's going to talk to us about addiction and recovery for Catholics. And our MC this year will be Kevin Spaulding. Kevin is a speaker, an author, and business life coach. You can go online now to www.catholicmenofthecarolinas.org. Make sure to use the promo code RADIO and save $5. We look forward to seeing you there on this awesome day full of faith, fellowship, and prayer. For the Catholic Men's Conference, Carolinas, the Obligation Radio Show, my name is Jason Murphy. God bless, and Esto Vir.
Welcome back to Prescription Life. Today we are talking with Dr. Stephen Samut. And I want to ask you, Dr. Samut, when we're talking about abortion pill reversal research, what's been done in the past, and what could be done in the future, you know, I know that it would be important to have a good animal model to be able to test these reversal protocols. How do you develop an animal model? What's the process for doing that, getting it approved, and then moving forward with that research?
Sure. I think one aspect I would like to clarify here, when we talk about animal models, I think a lot of people have, in a way, a lack of understanding of appropriate understanding what animal models are. These are not rats strutting down the... the displaying something that they're wearing. When we talk about an animal model, we're talking about a model of a disease. And there are certain criteria that need to be met. So if I may, let me just quickly explain.
Yes.
Here. So, for example, if in a human, if we observe in Parkinson's disease a tremor, then I would expect that an animal model of Parkinson's disease would also reflect that tremor. If in humans we give L-DOPA to assist with the relief of Parkinson's disease, then I would expect that if in an animal model I would be able to do the same and that I would observe the same. So with regards to animal models and how we use them, there need to be certain criteria that need to be met that match what we observe in humans. This obviously would make sense, otherwise it would be useless information. The reason why we are able to do that is because of the similarity in the brain. Yes, the human cortex is significantly more developed than that of a rat. However, the connectivity between the upper brain and lower brain is very similar. Obviously, in humans, then there's also the free will aspect. That aspect obviously plays a significant role in our behavior. However, when we are looking at purely the physiological level, there is a lot of similarity. And as I said, we focus on this relationship between the upper brain and the lower brain. So when looking at animal models, we seek to to ensure that we are mimicking as much as is possible, feasible, what is observed in humans. Obviously, there remain significant differences. A human life, for example, is approximately, let's say, on average, 8 years. 80 years, but rat only lives about 2 years. That's old age in the case of the rat. Adolescence is within about 7 to 10 weeks for a rat. So these are there are aspects that need to be kept in mind with regards to why we are able to use animal models. Ethics plays obviously a significant role. First of all, I will say at the outset that any scientist that abuses their animals is not just unethical, they are also stupid, because their results can never mean anything. Nobody ever functions normally under stress, and then animals do not function normally under stress either if they are inappropriately treated. Anybody that raises animals can vouch for this. So those aspects and animal ethics are really important. However, I must say that an aspect that I find somewhat disturbing as a scientist is that the regulations for the ethical treatment of animals are volumes and volumes of pages, whereas when it comes to the ethical treatment of humans, sometimes there are many questions that I wish to raise, because it seems sometimes that we treat more animals with humanely than we treat humans humanely. Again, that is not trying to condone in any way mistreatment of animals, on the contrary. So ensuring that you are ethically treating the animals, keeping them in conditions that are stable, appropriate food, water, temperature, humidity, all of these need to be monitored. In terms of ethical oversight, there generally is, in the same way that with humans, there is an institutional review board that reviews human research. In animals, we have what's called an Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee, for short, IACUC. This organization, or this group of people that consists of scientists, non-scientists, and even lay people external to the institution, review your research for ethics, for reasons why you're conducting it, the reasons behind it, the literature research that you've done, showing proof for necessity for this research, that you're not just uselessly replicating something that's already established. And all of that is reviewed by the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee. And then they give approval for you to conduct the research, and it has to be reviewed on a yearly basis. And if the experiment is still going after 3 years, then a new protocol needs to be submitted and re-reviewed and approval given in order for you to continue. We take care of the animals ourselves as well and ensure that we keep a clean facility. This just keeps the costs down significantly. We utilize rats in order to do our experiments. Rats have been shown to be a good model in numerous disease models. For example, I've previously utilized them for drug abuse, schizophrenia, Parkinson's disease, and we can have very legitimate models that replicate what we observe in humans. And I've also utilized them to measure depression, both in my PhD, during my PhD, and also what I am currently using them for in regards to the abortion study. So, yeah.
So I'm just curious, what were you using, how were you using them in schizophrenia research?
In schizophrenia, one of the aspects that you can investigate that is latent in inhibition in terms of the way, basically at the level of the neuron, the way the cortex processes or regulates the lower brain in terms of if the lower brain, in schizophrenia, the lower brain basically sees everything as a signal, and the upper brain is not regulating that aspect. So we can look at startle reflex, for example, in rats, and then also at the neurological level, looking at how the upper brain, lower brain, the communication becomes dysregulated in such models. And then we were also testing drugs that are being developed in order to be utilized for the treatment of schizophrenia. The last one that I was investigating was a phosphodiesterase 10 inhibitor that specifically targets neurons within a specific area of the brain, in the striatum, in the lower brain, that could potentially give us some idea or potentially be used in the treatment of schizophrenia. My role was to investigate the mechanisms and its impact on the neurotransmitters within that specific area of the brain. So, for example, dopamine, nitric oxide, and the like.
Gotcha. Okay, so shifting gears a little bit, I know that you have some ongoing studies and research going on, but I don't want to put you at jeopardy of telling too much about that. But just theoretically, when coming up with an animal model for abortion pill reversal, what do you have to consider for that special case?
Okay. So one of the aspects that is repeatedly mentioned in the psychological research is depression that women will suffer from after having had an abortion. And obviously there is a lot of controversy. Now, in that regard, people will argue against it, people will argue for it. Obviously, these studies are important, and what I am going to say, I do not wish to be misinterpreted as me diminishing the importance of these psychological studies, far from it. However, people can always argue that social influences and religion and faith play a significant role. Well, when you're dealing with a rat, yes, I do work at a Catholic university. However, it doesn't matter how much holy water I put on them or how much I sat with these rats trying to catechize them. It's not going to make any difference in the way that these rats behave. So the advantage of utilizing an animal model, a rat model, for example, in my case, is that conditions are very controlled, and social and faith influences do not play a role. We are looking at purely a physiological response. And if there is a depression is also a physiological response. Depression is not just something spiritual. Mm-hmm. Depression is a physiological response that involves a physiological imbalance in the brain in terms of neurotransmitters that ultimately result in issues with regards to behaviors that are reflected in behavior. These aspects we can address in a rat, because there is such a thing as a rat model of depression, which I can explain in more detail if you wish me to do so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would like, just a couple minutes on that would be interesting.
Sure. So the example that I always give is, many people love chocolate. When you are feeling down, if you love chocolate, the likelihood is you eat a lot of chocolate, more than usual or the same. However, if it's something that you really don't like, you don't like much, if you're distressed, depressed, stressed, the likelihood is that you'll go for it even less. Now, there are animal models that have been established that show similar behavior in rats when it comes to a sucrose solution, a sugar solution. If I give rats a 32% sugar solution, if they're depressed, stressed, they're likely to drink, and I've seen this, they will drink the same amount or more. However, if you give them a small concentration, like a 0.4% sucrose concentration sugar solution, that solution is barely tastes any different from regular water. And I know I'm anthropomorphizing here, but the rat, kind of, when you put them in the test cage with that solution, kind of gets the mentality of, well, I can't be bothered. I will drink when I feel like it, when I go back to my home cage. So when you give them a low concentration of a sugar solution, they won't drink as much, and that's been established in the literature as an indicator of depression. Anxiety, you can look at where the rats tend to sit in the cage or what they do. For example, they'll go to a back corner of a cage, kind of a safe space where they are far further away from the open area, which is intimidating to them. So these are established animal models that reflect similar human behavior that we observe and that is even reported in the DSM.
Interesting. Okay, well, we have one more break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about just kind of the theory of life-affirming research versus a lot of other research that we see going on. Stay tuned.
On January 31st, 2019, Carolina Catholic Media signed on Charlotte's first Catholic radio station, AM 1270 WCGC. By the grace of God, we celebrate the past 4 years and look forward to continuing our apostolic vision and mission to serve the Carolina Catholic community. We are evangelistic partners with our clergy, active parishioners, the fallen away, and the homebound. We are accessible to all Christians, agnostics, and atheists. With distribution of a wide array of content across 7 media platforms, there truly is something for everyone. During these past 4 years, Carolina Catholic has expanded to 7 media platforms that include radio, internet stream, mobile app, website, YouTube, social media, and e-newsletter. Nearly all local programs are available by podcast and video on demand. In the year ahead, we're committed to promote more local parish, school, and ministry events, more live broadcasts, and more valuable content that showcases our dynamic local Carolina Catholic community. Of all the Catholic radio stations in the U.S., Carolina Catholic is arguably a leader in locally produced programs. To continue our work, Carolina Catholic Media needs $15,000 in monthly funding to continue operations across our 7 media platforms. We are 100% dependent on your generosity. If you love what we're doing, please join us with a monthly tithe or annual gift. We have partnership plans available for parishes, schools, and ministries. If you own a business, you can be a program sponsor on one or all of our platforms. You can do a live broadcast of a special event with promotion before and rebroadcast after. On behalf of everyone at Carolina Catholic Media, we thank you for your past support and look forward to you joining us with the resources the apostolate needs to continue to evangelize the truth of Jesus Christ and our Catholic faith across the Carolinas. May God bless you and your family abundantly.
Welcome back to Prescription Life, and today we have with us Dr. Stephen Samut. Really having a good conversation with him about a lot of his research, and wanted to touch a little bit about just kind of the basic understanding of science, of research, of life-affirming research, and how more scientists should be speaking out about the part of research that should be life-affirming. What are your thoughts about that, Dr. Samut?
I feel sometimes that in the past, at least in the past 50 years, I feel, there's been this antagonism towards science in circles of faith. And I think that that's rubbing off in what we are observing. There are some scientists, but there are so few scientists that talk openly and in relation to define what science shows, the reality that science shows. So the science and faith do not contradict each other. Even in terms of, the thing is that our role is not to preach. That's for the pastors and the priests. But our role is, as scientists, our obligation is towards the truth. And that has to be our sole drive. We need to be searching for the truth and then sharing it as much as possible, with keeping in mind our limitations, with the public. So, for example, with regards to the abortion study in my case, I mean, I had this lingering question in my mind with regards to, well, okay, this is what people are reporting at the psychological level, but has anybody really addressed this aspect at the preclinical level in an animal model to look at the physiological consequences? And the answer really is no, because all the research that had been done on animals prior to what I did in 2019 had been looking and focused solely on how effective the abortion pill was in inducing an abortion. And to me, the question is, well, how can I address this in an objective, appropriate way, with rigor and integrity, so that the results stand for themselves? This is not a faith statement. This is a scientific statement with its limitations that need to be kept in mind, because this is an animal model. But in the same way, if animal models are good for testing so many things out there, then we should also apply it appropriately to this question. And sure enough, we saw anxiety-like and depression-like effects in our animals, which we then reported. Yes, we constantly urge caution in the interpretation of our results, but that's simple prudence, because as scientists, we always need to keep in mind our limitations. But at the same time, more scientists need to be standing out and speaking and doing these kinds of experiments, understanding that, yes, there may be consequences, because unfortunately we are seeing media censorship, we are seeing even scientific journal censorship of articles that don't fit the narrative that is being put forward. The reality is, you know, that there are, and I mean, if you look at the social media, for example, output that came out after I published that animal study, there's a lot of vile things that are said. We can't let those things bother us. On the other hand, we can't be silent. Obviously, we never should resort to vile commentary, or that is never acceptable. However, it is necessary for people to speak up the truth, and especially those people who have been given the gift, or contribute to the gift of academia, but which is truly a gift, because, you know, you've got the authority of the church, you've got the authority of the parents and the family, but then academia, in a way, I believe, sincerely believe, comes next. We have been obligated as scientists with the talents that God has given us in order to be able to utilize our talents to search for the truth and show, as St. Bonaventure says and many other saints say, the reality of God's existence as evident in nature around us. And that doesn't mean that you publish only things that suit you or that agree with your faith, because you need to keep in mind your own limitations and the potentiality that maybe you made mistakes. But the reality is, if you set up experiments in appropriate ways and do them properly and then seek to analyze your data with a critical mind, the reality is the truth will show itself in your results. The results, you need to let the results speak for themselves. As in the abortion study, for example, the results spoke for themselves in what we saw. And also, with regards to the abortion per reversal, which we are in the process of having reviewed currently, but it doesn't hurt to say that we observed progesterone reversing the an initiated abortion in rats. A rat that did not receive progesterone, the abortion proceeded to the end. Rats that received progesterone, in approximately 80% of cases, we observed pregnancy to term. And again, you follow logic, common sense, pharmacology, science. We bring all of these together, but we need more scientists, people who have the know-how to be speaking out more actively, more proactively, and not just sitting on the back seat waiting for those people who don't necessarily support life or don't support life, period, to be doing all of the talking.
Yeah, and certainly, I mean, in the history of science, you know, Copernicus, Mendel, a lot of these people were churchmen, were clergy who investigated the heavens, who investigated all the way down to the genetics of plants, and have introduced great theories and achieved great things to help us to understand the truth of God's creation. And so we need more of that. We need more recognition of that. We need more people of faith that are willing to continue in scientific research. And you know, as we all know, the closer we get to truth, the closer we get to God. And so that's what most scientists end up finding, is even if they started out far away from God, so many of them, when they discover the truth of creation, get closer.
That's very true. And the reality is, unfortunately, and the reason I think why this has become such an urgent necessity is because, unfortunately, it's become commonplace that university is for everybody. Everybody has to go to university. Everybody has to have a degree, as if it is the degree that gives you the dignity that you deserve, and that's not true at all. So, unfortunately, we have many scientists who are, if you can even call them that, who are in the field and are not necessarily there out of a passion to seek the truth. And this is a reality we are grappling with, and this is why it is even more necessary that those scientists who are genuine in their search for truth speak out even more so. Because realistically, as I said, and I continue to stand by, a scientist's own sole obligation is towards the search for the truth. If that's not the goal of the scientist, if it's anything else but that, then that person is a fraud. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, these are great philosophical points that must be upheld. Tell me, Dr. Samut, what do you have looking into the future, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years? What type of areas of research are you interested in continuing or going further into?
So given now that we have the abortion model, one aspect that I would like to continue going forward with is investigating the consequences of that abortion at a deeper level. And this is done at the neurophysiological level, looking at the electrical activity in the brain and the way the upper brain communicates with the lower brain, and whether there's changes between rats that have an abortion relative to rats that don't. So there's that aspect of looking at the electrophysiology. There's the electrochemistry. How does the neurotransmitter, how do the neurotransmitters change in terms of release within those areas of the brain? How are they affected following an abortion? Following that aspect, there's also more research that needs to be done, because if we rewire the brain, if we change the wiring in the brain, the wiring between the upper brain and the lower brain, then there's further consequences that can result as a result of that. So this is why, for example, going back to a more of a human example, when you have a person may start using pornography and then ultimately potentially ends up raping somebody. This is how it proceeds. It's because of the continuous rewiring that takes place in the brain, negative rewiring, bad wiring. And so the question that is in my mind is, if given given we observe anxiety and depression-like behaviors, what are the physiological consequences of this at the neurological level, chemically, electrophysiologically, and then also what other impacts do they have on the rat's behavior? For example, do the rats that receive an abortion have their wiring changed in such a way that, for example, their behavior becomes more susceptible towards becoming addicted to drugs of abuse? We see a significant amount of drug abuse among people who have had an abortion. And yes, obviously, reflection upon what has taken place potentially plays a role, but we also cannot underestimate the influence at the neurological level, the chemistry that has changed as a result of what has taken place. So those are aspects that I would like to investigate in the future, and also the interaction between the mother and future pups. If you're from future pregnancies, how does that change? Does it change? Or the interaction between males and females? Is there any difference in the way a female that has had an abortion previously interacts with a male? These are all aspects that I would really like to investigate, because I know that we've seen those reports at the human level. It would be really great if we could get some foundation in understanding what's going on in animal models, because we do have animal models that could potentially investigate and address those questions.
Yeah, there's so much work that can be done there, very important work that could really relate a lot to the human condition there. So, okay, well, thank you. I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule up there in Steubenville. Next time I'm up there, I'll definitely will hunt you down and we'll get together. Anything you want to tell our audience before we sign out for today?
I guess the one point I would like to tell the audience is to look, to always search for the truth, to look for the evidence. And if the evidence and common sense should match, the evidence and faith should match, and to be inquisitive and critical in their thinking.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Samut. I really appreciate your time. You have a great day. And again, we'll have you back in the future when you have some more research to talk about.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. And God bless your work.
All right. God bless you too.
You've been listening to Prescription Life with Dr. Matthew Harrison on the Carolina Catholic Radio Network, 1270 AM Charlotte, and streaming at carolinacatholicmedia.org and on the Carolina Catholic Media app.